As John pointed out, my strong training, my solid training is in the Tibetan Buddhist world or the Himalayan Tantric Buddhist world, which is Triyana Buddhism. And Buddha, when he brought together his enlightenment tradition, wasn't reinventing the spiritual wheel, but rather he brought together four elements from four great traditions, all of which had become somewhat diffused and diluted over the centuries and millennium, and he put them together into the package that we know as Buddha Dharma, or the way of enlightenment. And of those four, one of my favorites is coming from the northern lands, the shamanic traditions, bringing the knowledge of the ancient Himalayan, Altai-Himalayan masters. And they really start as far south as the Himalayas of India and go all the way up to the Altai of eastern Russia, of Siberia, and so forth. The other element, of course, is the yogas of light traditions coming from eastern Persia and the Silk Road. I think elements that were shared everywhere from Alexandria in Egypt all the way to the tip of Korea and down into Japan, a kind of a pan-Asian, if you will, tradition of meditation and sort of formless contemplation. Thirdly, he brought together the East Indian or Orissa traditions of using the chakras and the nadis, and the kundalini yogas, which he termed chandali yogas, the yogas of energy balance and inner power. And fourthly, from South India, bringing together the traditions of using every life situation without any exception as a path for enlightenment. So those four elements are what Buddha brought together into the Indo-Himalayan tradition that we know as Triyana Buddhism. And different countries around the world, I think, chose different elements for their emphasis from within that plethora or that smorgasbord of spiritual applications. And I think sometimes we see a little bit of pushing and pulling in Mongolia between shamans and Buddhist monks, because often these things get used for political purposes. And when you have one king who's a shaman and another king who's a Buddhist, there have been certain periods when there was some conflict between the shamans and the Buddhists. But generally, as the greatest living Mongolian Lama today, Purbat Lama, puts it, the ancient shamanism of Mongolia is a strong element of the Buddhist Tantra. And for that reason, the great Genghis Khan and Godang Khan, Hublai Khan, Odai Khan, all the early Mongol emperors were both good Buddhists and good shamans. Some people think that perhaps Genghis was a little bit too fierce to be a good Buddhist, but anyway, a Buddhist. And as Purbat Lama puts it, one of the reasons why he deeply admired the Buddhist tradition was because of that shamanic element that Buddha brought into the enlightenment tradition of the Indo-Himalayas. For tonight, I wanted to share with you a couple of things. Since I've been traveling, of course, through the Himalayas for the last decade or so, the last 30 years through the Himalayas, or actually 42 years through the Himalayas, but only 30, because 10 of them I was much more time in Mongolia on the steppes and in the Gobi. So about 30 years in the Himalayas and a decade or so up in the steppes and the Gobi, and getting to know many of the shamans up there. And I wanted to begin with a little 10-minute video, a kind of very amateurish effort, a very professional effort with an amateurish execution. A year and a half ago, I took a very professional movie company from LA to film Shamans of the World, and we began by filming an annual shaman festival in Mongolia, where something like maybe 3,000 to 5,000 shaman enthusiasts gather every spring out in the snows, and they drum and dance for 3 days and go into very profound states of trance. So we went up and they shot their film on a, you know, $50,000 camera and all of that. I took my little camera and passed it around to various shaman friends to try and get a less professional but more intimate look at the way the shamanic experience is done, is experienced. So I wanted to start with that because even though the camera work is it's done by amateur cinematographers, but professional shamans. And without them doing it, to get that kind of intimacy of footage would have been very difficult, to get the cameras that close to the various shamans in trance and at the fire rite and those kind of things would have been very difficult. That shaman, his name is Byampa Dorje, which is actually a Buddhist name. Byampa means he was born on Saturday. In the Tibeto-Mongolian tradition, a lot of people, their first name is a day of your birth. So there's a lot of Tibetans and Mongolians with the word Nyima for born on Sunday, Dawa born on Tuesday, Mi'kmaq born on Wednesday, Lakpa born on Wednesday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Purpa born on Thursday, Basang born on Friday, and Byampa born on Saturday. And his name, Byampa Dorje, which is a Buddhist name. Dorje is Vajra, coming from India, translation, Dorje in Tibetan. And Mongolians kind of use the old old pronunciation of both Sanskrit and Tibetan words. So in Sanskrit, they don't pronounce the final ah on syllables, like as, instead of dharma, it's dharam. Instead of karma, it's karam, and so on. And instead of Buddha, Bud. And the same with the final E in the Tibetan, Dorje just becomes Dorje. And he was formerly the state shaman or the presidential shaman. And I had met him quite early. And then when I was traveling with the Theosophical Society after Tibet, about 20 of us went to Mongolia for a few weeks. And he happened to be in one of the camps we were staying in. And one of our friends, who isn't here today, he was supposed to come for the weekend, but he's from San Antonio, Texas. And you know what those Southerners are like. When it comes to like battles and wars, they're brave as heck. When it comes to a few snow flurries or a spot of ice in the road, their courage slips away. So unfortunately, Das and his wife Joyce, who were planning to come for the weekend, had to cancel because of the fear of the ice and the snow flurries. But anyway, we went up a sacred mountain, and I told everyone on that going up that they had to wear good shoes. And he showed me his shoes, which were basically, I don't know, a golf course kind of shoes with zero traction and zero ankle support. He said, "What about these?" And I said, "No, better not to bother." He came along anyway and cracked his ankle. Don't laugh, guys. It's not funny. But the next day we met, bumped into Byampa Dorje, the state shaman, and he did a little ritual of healing over his leg, and because of that, we didn't have to amputate. Almost had to amputate, but we let him go with it. In Das's favor, he was very determined to complete the pilgrimage. He said, you can't send me back to UB. I wanted to send him back to the city to be x-rayed and whatnot. He said, just put my leg in a cast and have people carry me the rest of the way. So for the next week or 10 days, people carried him up, put him on the van, carried him off the van, into temples, carry him in, put him down. But all's well that ends well. And thanks to Byumpa Dorje doing a little ritual on him and a kind of a therapeutic touch healing, things went well in the long run, and he now walks with just a minor limp. Probably no limp at all, I don't know. But we met, anyway, we all became friends with Byumpa Dorje at that time. And I continued to visit him a couple of times a year over the years to follow. I had probably another dozen or so shaman friends in Mongolia, but the 10-minute movie we're going to see is just a video from the annual Mother Tree Shaman Festival. And basically what happens there is about maybe 20 or 30 master shamans come, each with their dozens or several hundred students, and then the several hundred or more each group has of their relatives and well-wishers and patrons and so on. Generally, they don't sleep for the 3 days, and most of them just fast, and basically they do a all-night drumming and all-night singing, and with the jaws harp, as I mentioned, go into trance. So after we show the film, I made a PowerPoint presentation with some slides showing just various kind of shamanic images, if you will. And I'll say a little bit about each one of those. And then at the end, I'll read you a shamanic song of invocation. And we'll do questions and discuss answers and discussion. Okay? Festival at the Mother Tree, the tree which is the mother of the great shaman experience. We have two of the state shamans are here, the new one who's the state oracle of the country, and the previous one, Byumpa Dorje, whose ceremony is beneath the Mother Tree over here.
Thank you. Most of Mongolians are very shy.
Yeah, during the communist time, Mongolia was taken over by the Russian communists in 1924, and things started to be, at first I think everyone thought things would go well. It would be a kind of a socialist utopia, so no one was that upset. But within 4 or 5 years, the government showed the other side of what communism has shown in many countries, which is a kind of a very oppressive and anti-spiritual demeanor. And over the next 10 years, Mongolia's 1,250 monasteries and temples were all destroyed. All the monks either killed or imprisoned or deported to gulags in Siberia. And the shamans were similarly outlawed. It became illegal to practice shamanism. But nonetheless, humans always find ways to continue things they like to do. So Buddhism and shamanism both went underground. And it was those very brave peoples who maintained it under those oppressive situations that basically brought it through the almost 70 years of communist rule. As Byumpa Dorje once said in one of his conversations I had with him, that if the government knew one was practicing shamanism or speaking positively about shamanism in the harsh years of 1940 to maybe 1975 or so, 1980, it could lead to imprisonment and even deportation to the Siberian gulags, and perhaps even to death. So they very bravely maintained it as underground traditions, usually passed by father, son, father, daughter. In Byumpa Dorje's case, two of his daughters are trained shamans and practicing shamans. They make their living as shamans. As healers and as doing other kind of shamanic work. I think in the ancient times, we use that word shaman. I think in ancient times, a shaman was pretty much a combination of a medicine man, a priest, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and a doctor. They all carried pouches of medicine and gave wise, sagacious advice to everyone from young people looking for marriage partners and older people looking to have their kids and grandkids do well in life, and to ordinary material matters like a good life, good career, and so on. So Byumpa Dorje is considered to be one of the main players in the revival of Mongolian shamanism. So from 1990, when communism fell and it became legal to practice shamanism, he was one of the first to stick out his neck and publicly accept students. Because now it's looking back, it was nothing bad happened. But many times in history, when things changed like that, the change would be temporary. And putting out your neck and putting your life on the line like that, the next year, things could change back to how they had been. And his, since that time, has trained several hundred shamans, and several dozen of them have gone on to become really very strong shamanic masters in their own right. And I thought to talk a little bit about shamanism using the slides. So this is Pyumpa Dorje's favorite picture of himself. And it was taken actually by an Australian photographer visiting the country. And the Mongolian script on the side was introduced by Genghis Khan. It's known as the standing script, although you could call it the dribbling script because it starts on top and it's written down. So you start on the top left-hand side of the page and you write your line down like this and then go to the next line and write down, next line and write down. After Genghis Khan, his grandson Kublai Khan made the whole empire Buddhist. So he made this script the official secular script of the Mongolian Empire, including China, Korea, Tibet, and so forth, and the Tibetan script, the spiritual script of the empire. So from that time until today, Mongolians learn both this script and the Tibetan script introduced by Kublai Khan in about 1250 or so. And in 1941, the Russians pushed them to stop using these old traditional scripts and to use Russian Cyrillic. So if you travel in Mongolia today, you'll notice that all the road signs and restaurant signs are either in English or Russian Cyrillic. And most Mongolians learn Russian Cyrillic from grade one in school until graduation, and they write their tests and they write their university papers and theses and so forth in the Russian Cyrillic. But it's, of course, it's Mongolian language written in that Cyrillic. Usually they use that mirror in front, and that's the shaman's mirror is considered to be a very special mirror. In one of Pyumpa Dorje's books, he gives us a chapter to how he got it. There was a very famous shaman in the 50s, one of the last great living ones from the old pre-communist times. And when he got very old, that was his mirror. So he left it to someone and said, "You hold this and you're going to meet a very great shaman. And when you meet that shaman, though destined to have this mirror, you'll know it's him. And so give this mirror to him." So that shaman comes from before communist times, before 1924, from the great shaman, one of the great shamans who survived the Holocaust and I think died in the 50s or early 60s, something like that. Mongolians always, shamans like to smoke pipes. They also smoke cigarettes, much like our North American natives. And when they invoke spirits, they talk about the 99, the 55 white astrological or cosmic. They're from the sky. Tingir literally means sky. So sky forces, the 55 white sky forces and the 44 black sky forces. And the white and the black there don't mean good and bad, but rather they mean ways of easy solution and easy progress, and the other being a more kind of forceful or wrathful solution, forceful or wrathful progress. In the time of Genghis Khan, if he was moving in a time of peace, he would hang white flags from his traveling gear, his sort of gear mobile. And if it was a time of war, he would put up the black ones. This, which became Nicholas Rorick, borrowed this symbol from Mongolian shamans in the Rorick logo, used by Rorick and everything from his Rorick Peace Pact and the establishment of the Rorick Master Institute in New York, and throughout all of his life it became his symbol. But it's actually a very ancient shamanic symbol. And sometimes in shamanic rituals, particular kind of rituals, they draw a large circle, and inside they'll make a small circle where the shaman sits, and a second small circle where the recipient of the ritual sits, and the third circle will have these three. And in the shamanic world, the three mean how above is heaven, below is earth, in between we living beings. and how happiness, peace, well-being, health, and so forth all come when heaven, earth, and living beings live in balance and harmony. So in many ways, the shaman sees himself, his role, as creating harmony between heaven, here meaning the space forces, the Tingir, the sky forces, the 99 plus 1. 55 white, 44 black, and ruling over the 99, the Ektengir, the great sky. So many Mongols name their kid Ektengir, great sky. A little bit like in Mexico, a lot of people get called Jesus. Like, haven't you got a potential mayor coming up with that name? What's his other name? Chewy. Which is also a nice name. And I saw him for the first time looking at the news last night. He looks like a very nice guy. Good smile. And around the three circles, the big circle, is how these three things, heaven, earth, and living beings, have a sense of their own independence of one another. In fact, they're not independent. They're all held within the same great spacious void. I included this one because as shamanism spread down through Tibet and into India, into China, into Korea and Japan, and many of those countries became Buddhist, the Buddhists borrowed the old shamanic symbol. They took the bit at the center, which is a shamanic symbol, and they put the Noble Eightfold Wheel on the outside for the Buddhist Eightfold Path of right discipline and right livelihood and right good talking and good thinking and so forth, and just sort of added it to the shamanic way of thinking. So in that way, and the official school of Buddhism in Korea, the Zen Buddhist school, or Chogye as they're known, the Sun, they use this as their national symbol on all of their letterhead and above all of their, I don't know, I think they've got 1,500 temples or something like that. But they use the old shamanic symbol combined with the Buddhist symbol. At the same time, they kind of grumble about shamans being a little bit primitive and not quite as sophisticated as the Buddhists. The Ovo. This is perhaps the Mongolian shaman's favorite marker. Whenever one crosses a path and also on sacred mountains, they always put up this ovo as kind of a antenna for drawing the sacred forces, the Tengir, the sky forces or the space forces. And very often they will come here and do their ovos at sacred occasions and perform their rituals. The cloths hanging from the ovos, from the posts, are Tibetan katas. Tibetans call them katak. But Tibetans often use white ones, because when you go to meet someone, you give them a white scarf. If you don't have anything else to give them, at least you should give a white scarf. And otherwise, you can give them some horses or camels or big load of butter, something like that, some jewels. But in Mongolia, they like the blue kata because it represents the blue Tingir, the great space forces, Ektingir. And some of the more popular shamanic ritual places, you'll have hundreds of trees marked like this, all of which are believed to be great energy conduits for spatial energies. So a little bit like in the Druidic and Celtic traditions of Europe, the idea of ley lines and where ley lines cross, the kind of sacred energies that can be channeled there. And one, of course, every place is equally sacred in some ways, but in another way, some places it's easier for humans to notice the sacred quality. I think the idea is something like that. And this place is not too far from Ulaanbaatar. And every year, some thousands of shamans gather here over the summer and perform either 3 or 6 days of fasting, no sleep, dancing and drumming for that period. This is a female shaman doing the morning offering. So first thing shamans do in the morning is go out from the gear, their yurt or their tent, and they toss either four directions, either milk or vodka or both. And often milk to the female spirits and vodka to the male spirits. Milk for requests of peace and abundance, and vodka in times of danger and difficulty. So here she's tossing milk. And in the summer, of course, they toss horse milk wine or horse milk beer, Erik, fermented horse milk. So if you ever come to Mongolia in June or July, Mongolians often stop eating much food during the summer and will just drink a gallon and a half of fermented horse milk, mare's milk beer. And because the horses eat lots of wild flowers at that time of year, like the fields are just covered in carpets of flowers, then the milk has a lot of medicinal quality. So if you can do that for 2 weeks of the year, you can never catch colds or flus or other contagious diseases.
How do you spell that, Eric? Maybe E-R-R-E-I-G-C-H-H-H.
Mongolians have a lot of words like a little bit like the Dutch and the Finland people in that regard. So this is a traditional Mongolian gear. And here they've hung up their 9 banners. And they're white, meaning it's a time of peace, and so everyone's celebratory and a low caution mood. If it was considered to be a time of danger, like if marauding bands of Chinese robbers were in the area, everyone would put up black, and then from a distance you'd see black and you'd know there's marauding bands of robbers in the area. In olden days, marauding bands of robbers mostly tried to steal wives, because, you know, a good wife is hard to find. So one reason Genghis Khan's father was assassinated when Genghis Khan was a child was the father had fallen in love with this girl when he was about 10 years old, and they had sort of promised each other that when they grew up they would marry, according to Genghis Khan. You know, the girl may have had a different story. And so then later her hand was promised, because she was a princess, Genghis Khan was a king, Genghis Khan's dad was a king, and so later she was promised to someone else and married off to someone else. So he slipped away in the night and rode into their camp when they're all sleeping and wife-napped her, and took her back to his camp. And they went on to make quite a few children and live a happily life. And the story is always told like that's what she really wanted, like it was really a, you know, mutually designed plan. And anyway, the other tribe never kind of got over it, so maybe 20 years later or something, someone from the other tribe poisoned Genghis Khan's dad, which led eventually to Genghis as one of the young princes being exiled from the kingdom, because the uncle wanted to take over as king. And he almost died, but because the uncle felt like killing a boy would be a great shame on his name, just exiled him and his mother and the mother's other kids to the northern country to live by the river. And usually it was very difficult for people to survive just by themselves in exile. So he had sort of hoped they would pass away, I think. But instead of that, of course, Genghis eventually grew up and came back with an army and took over and then created the biggest continuous land empire the world has ever known. By the time he died at age 66. And again, those tridents on the top of the banners hung by shamans, again, this is a very ancient Pan-Asian tradition, the Shivites of India carry tridents like this when they wander from place to place. One sees it on Shiva temples. One sees it in on the tops of all Tibetan houses and Tibetan monasteries. So it's very much a Pan-Asian symbol. And often we see a kind of a, everyone interprets it in their own way. The Indians interpret it as Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the sustainer, and Ishvara, the destroyer, the sacred trinity of creator, sustainer, and destroyer that leads to the birth of humans, the lifespan of humans, the death of humans, the birth of a universe, the life of a universe, the death of a universe, birth of a star, life of a star, death of a star, and so on. For the shamans, of course, it has the same meaning as above, central to everything, the forces of the Tingir, the heavenly forces or astrological forces. Below that, the forces of the earth and of nature, and between us living beings trying to bring balance, or trying to live in balance. And some shaman gears just have the simple banners on the doorway like this. This shaman just wanted to show his sort of the way the northern shamans often make their ovo and their sacred marks. They make them kind of like teepees. And in the south, in the steppes and in the Gobi, Mongols live in gir. They're sort of tea cozy looking houses like we've seen. But in the far north, they live in teepees, urta, as they're called. And here in the west, we call all them yurt, which the Russians learned from the teepees of the north. And of course, when our North American natives crossed the Bering Strait from the Mongol territories, they brought the teepee with them, the urta with them. But as you go further north, even the ovos, the sacred symbols, take on the ovo look, take on the urta look. The shamanic idea of chakras is slightly different than the Indian one. That basically just the energy flows from up and below, and the roles of the seven chakras are quite different than in India and in Tantric Buddhism. But nonetheless, we see the chakras used both in dance and in meditation. I included this one for some of the drums, and this is a valley very close to Ulaanbaatar, the sacred Taralj Valley, and we went there with the Theosophical group when we were in the country. But it's a very sacred valley, and shamans have gathered there for many, many thousands of years. And it was also one of the places where the Kalachakra, the Shambhala, that prophecies are linked to this valley. And before communists destroyed it, the greatest Kalachakra temple in Mongolia was in that. If we go further north into Buryat, these are known as the white shamans. And they wear the same kind of headdresses, but their outfits, they wear a lot of white. And according to some anthropologists, they came from further east and actually moved up from Korea in ancient times. So I like to include that because I spend about 4 months a year in Korea. And Korea, I teach in a Buddhist temple, but because I like shamans, the shamans are always inviting me to speak at their conferences. And so I always mention the connection between the white shamans of Siberia. That's Lake Baikal in the background, the sacred Lake Baikal. And that's often considered to be the sort of world headquarter for Mongol shamanism. It was part of Mongolia, of course, for centuries and centuries, and became part of Tsarist Russia in the 1850s. And when Russia broke up in the 1990s, it almost came back with Mongolia. But by that time, a lot of sort of white Siberians had moved in, really meaning Russians, white Russians, as opposed to Mongols. So they slightly outnumbered the Mongol population. And so they won the vote not to join Mongolia. Otherwise, they would have reunited with Mongolia. This is Byampa Dorje doing a fire ritual. And the fire ritual is considered sacred for every commencement activity and ending activity. I thought I'd say a little bit about Hemor. and the traveling horse, the sacred horse. According to shamanic myth, humans long time ago were not descended from apes or monkeys. We came from another planet riding on a flying horse. So I don't know why in the West we have this thing of flying saucers. Must be all those teetotaling Britishers and their fascination with saucers. In reality, it was a flying horse that we came from. And people who know Nicholas Rorick, the great Russian-born New York artist who lived and painted in Mongolia for some time and then lived the last 20 years of his life in India, or last 15 in India, he did quite a few paintings of the flying horse, bearing Chintamani, the wish-fulfilling jewel, or the sacred jewel. And the idea of these jewels of power brought from another planet are quite strong throughout all of Asia, sort of special rocks, touchstones, if you will, that if you carry them, if you have them on your person, if you put them in your home, it brings special blessings, special energy from the other planets. Sort of like little, what was that word? Any of you see A Space Odyssey, the Tim Allen film? The transponders. brings in signals from the other world systems. But Nicholas Rorick spent a lot of his time wandering around Central Asia looking for Shambhala, where allegedly the mother load of these power jewels are kept. And very often, even this is, I think, an 8th century carving of this legendary flying horse on which the first humans came to planet Earth. And according to the legend, they landed, like if you were to draw a line from Ulaanbaatar to Lhasa, the old camel route that went from Ulaanbaatar to Lhasa, right on the border of Tibet and Mongolia, just after you get into the Tibetan hills. That's where they allegedly landed. And when Nicholas Rorick was passing through, he said they kept seeing like flying, unidentified flying objects. And at one point, he and his son and his wife, Helena, disappeared into the mountains for the better part of a week. And none of the rest of the 200 people in the camp knew where they were. But according to him and Helena's diaries, they went in to visit the mother lode. Also, when the 13th Dalai Lama traveled from Tibet to Mongolia in 1905, after the British invasion of Tibet in 1904, in the 04-05, the winter, the previous Dalai Lama traveled through that area and camped there, and he pointed to the mountain. He said, oh, by the way, that's where we say the valley of Shambhala is located, and this legend of the flying horse is based. So this horse is like a 1,000 or 1,200 year old creation of a shaman artist showing what the real flying saucer looks like. I suppose if you see it late at night with lights shining, it just looks like a saucer. The other thing about Himor is Himor is used not only as this cosmological force, but as the idea of the horse as our symbol of kind of personal strength, personal power, our immunity system, our power of self-healing, also for our power of life. So Genghis Khan advocated that every self-respecting man, woman, and child should own 8 horses, termed the 8 horses of happiness. That if everyone had 8 horses, they would be much happier. Of course, your backyard would be smellier. But you could produce your own energy for driving your own car. Last year, when I took the 33 Scandinavian Alice Baileyites to Tibet, one of them, his next door neighbor, has 40 cows, and he uses the manure from the 40 cows to produce gobar gas or methane. and it produces enough from 40 cows to power 200 cars. So 200 local cars exclusively get their gas from him, just from 40 cows, dairy cows. And of course, young artists today still like to sort of show this. So this is a very modern painting by an artist friend of mine in Mongolia. And I thought to include it just because I always travel with some Mongolian art pieces to raise money for my projects in Mongolia. Unfortunately, I don't have any by her. But when Mongolians at a horse race, after the horse race, all the Mongolians run up to the horses and rub their body to get a bit of sweat from the horse and then rub it on their forehead and their throat and their heart, sort of like Buddhists do to bless the body, the speech, and the mind, to give you a better brain, a more horsey brain, a more horsey speech, and a more horsey thoughts. So himor in this way means a kind of your personal charisma, your personal power, your ability to succeed in everything that you do. And so much of what a shaman does in life isn't directly directed at what is what they consider the symptom of the problem. Like you can't get a good job, you can't get a good relationship, you can't conceive children, you're always getting diseases, you've got all these problems. What's the real problem? It's not those things happening. It's your horsepower is low. You're really a 300 horsepower person, but you're only running on 150 horsepowers. So you have to amp up your horsepower, your himor. So almost everything a Mongolian shaman does is aimed at increasing the person's himor. Buddhism borrows himor. So this idea of these sort of animal energies being an important part of the human experience comes into Buddhism through these, what they call this is called the lungta, and lungta is literally a Tibetan translation of the word himor. Prayer, we often call it a prayer flag, but it's not a prayer. Lung means wind, and ta is horse. It means the wind horse or the flying horse. And by hanging one of those above your house, everything in your life starts going better. I should have brought some along to sell, huh? And, you know, I had a friend come from England who had had a bad back for like 10 years and bad digestion. And his dad was a doctor, so the dad really took it as a personal kind of challenge to cure him, and nothing ever cured him. And he came out to visit me. So I said, oh, we'll go visit my Lama friend who does good divinations. And the Lama did the divination. They said, oh, the problem is with your horse energies. So just hang six rows of flying horse flags over your house and you'll be cured in 3 days. And so he immediately ran out and brought a bunch of these strings of prayer flags. I'm sure if you look at the wonderful, wonderful film that Steve and Chris made on our visit to Tibet with the Theosophical Society, you'll see us hanging wind horses, banners on all the sacred places. And of course, because of that, everyone did much better. So some of the lungta, or flying horse banners, as they're called in the Tibetan Buddhist world, are even more overtly and directly definable or identifiable for their himor quality. This is just a very famous shaman drum in one of the national museums from one of the great shamans of the 1920s. This is Gyampa Dorje's private drum used at his grand ceremonies when he's with 200 or 300 students and initiation ceremonies and grand training festivals. And this is him again. The jaws harp, most of them are made of metal, and the best ones are made of meteorite metal. Because, of course, meteorite metal being associated with the tingir, the forces of space. Also, with Tibetan Buddhist world, having anything made from meteorite metal, a vajra made from meteorite metal, and so on, is considered especially powerful for certain kinds of rituals. Then I just conclude the thing with a bunch of shaman hats. I'm a bit of a hat enthusiast. You know, in the Tibetan and Buddhist world, when a master dies, the one he gives his hat to becomes his main Dharma heir. He inherits the monastery, the hermitage, becomes responsible for maintaining the whole practice regime and the whole institution. Even big places like Drepung, which had 10,000 monks and probably 1,000 or so branch monasteries, whoever the head lama gave the hat to became head of all of that. So similarly, shaman hats often indicate a particular lineage of shamanism coming down over the centuries through a particular lineage of masters. So I chose here my 10 favorite hats. There used to be a thing in the 30s and 40s where men took real pride in their hats. These days, people will put like a dirty sock on their head almost. But the hat is, for shamans, the head is your most sacred place. So they're very, very careful about everything to do with hat and head. So that I put that as number one, because that's one of my favorites. And just like our native North Americans are very big worshippers of the eagle and of the large hawks, so the shamans very often wear eagle feathers and hawk feathers. And this fellow, I have hair just wandering around. Later, I've got another one of another of his tribe of shaman. But that big Viking look with the big horns. Now, according to some archaeological studies, the Vikings actually found a riverway going across northern Russia, down through Mongolia into China. They found Vikings who traveled that whole way by the inner water routes and portage routes to get down through, all the way through through Russia, through Mongolia, and down into northern China. And my theory is they could have brought that hat with them because it's a very Viking-style hat. This photo was taken by Hamid Sardar, a wonderful American Iranian. His dad was one of the people kicked out of Iran by the Shah when the Shah died and the Khomeini took over. And he graduated from Harvard and lived in Nepal for a long time studying Buddhism, and then was sent by CSIS Students International from America to Mongolia to set up a program there. But he's made a lot of films. He's become a very well-known filmmaker. So you should watch for his films, Hamid Sardar. And the first three of his films all won international awards, like the Tallahassee Best Documentary and Toronto Film Festival. And the present one that just released this year won the Cannes Festival for Best Asian Documentary. But he's also a great photographer. And he spends a lot of time up in the north in the forest lands. The tribes live with rainbows, reindeer, and they ride reindeer. So now we have discovered Santa's actual residence. It's not the North Pole. You have to cross the North Pole and come down about 1,000 miles the other side, and they all ride reindeer. And if you go up there, you can rent a reindeer for like $10 a day to ride. And I've ridden one. The poor little reindeer had to struggle. And all of the tribes keep herds of reindeers, often 50 or 100 reindeers. They ride them everywhere and milk them. And they also make alcohol out of the milk, like they do with camel milk and horse milk. Yeah, so this was my favorite guy at Byampa Dorje's Mother Tree Festival that was in the first part of the film. And some of the guys, when they do their drumming and their dancing, they get very wild in the dances, so they really hop about very, very ferociously. Of course, in the festival, we saw them hopping around a lot, but because there's 300 or 400 of them very close, they can't hop too hard or too fast. But when they do their individual trance dances, it's very much almost like wild Sufi dancing where they really spin and almost fly. And in this picture here, we really catch a sense of that. I included this one partly for his feathers, his eagle feathers, which are absolutely brilliant, but also because he just looks so Navajo. I mean, if you were to show this to a Navajo, he would not know that this was a Mongolian. And if he saw it was a Mongolian, he'd say, how do those damn Mongolians kidnap a Navajo? That's a painting by this painter, Herr Solma. And when I brought the film crew to Mongolia last year to do the shaman film, we sponsored a Mongolian shaman art exhibition. And so I had one of the six artists whom I brought to New York curate it, and we invited, I think it was 25 different artists, all of whom have won national awards for their excellence, to each contribute a piece. And it was very wonderful. They showed at the Prestige Gallery in Ulaanbaatar, and they were all on television for the work and that sort of stuff. And this was Solma's entry, and it was my favorite piece, this piece of the shaman in a wild, wild invocation dance. The nice thing about it is a year later when I was just there like 3 weeks ago, I visited for a couple of weeks, I was sitting with a half dozen of the artists, and one of them asked me, what was your favorite painting in the exhibit? And I said, well, I have a weakness for Solma's paintings. I love her style. So I think hers was my favorite. So the day I was leaving for the airport, she had someone deliver me a little gift, and it was this painting as a sort of a thank you for organizing the exhibit. And this painting is by this artist, Nirma, who is my other very, very favorite artist in the country. She won Best Female Artist of the Country in 2006, and Solma won it in 2008, I think it was. But that shaman dance, very often three or four shamans will do monthly invocations together and do this kind of fire dance. And if they do it for extended periods of time, it'll often be 3 days with no food and no sleep and just invocation, drumming, and dance. So going into trance, I once discussed the drug situation, you know, because many of our shamans in North America, like in New Mexico, the Hopi and the Pueblos, these guys all take peyote. And in Canada, our North American shamans usually use the magic mushrooms. So I asked them, the Mongolian shamans, and they said generally up in the Lake Baikal area, in the far Siberia area, they use mushrooms. But the steppe people and the Gobi people don't use any psychotropics for their invocation. They do fasting, sleep deprivation, and many days of dancing, sometimes a week or 10 days with just 24 hours of drumming and dancing until they more or less faint from it, and then they play the invocation harp for a relaxation for a little bit. And I end with the mother tree, which is where the film festival that we've filmed was at.
My question's about, at the festival, most of the shamans seemed their eyes were covered, but only at the festival. What was that about?
Very often at mass invocations, they wear this headdress where pieces of wool come down right over the eyes to about this level. And often when Tibetan lamas and Mongolian Buddhist lamas do particular kinds of very strong Dharmapala invocations, things they call trinsol, invocation of enlightenment energy or enlightenment blessings, they wear a hat where that same thing is used, where the hat ends here, and then you've got little pieces of thread or pieces of wool hanging down, often made from yak tail or horse tail hairs woven together into very thick. And I asked one of the shamans about it, and I also earlier I'd asked lamas about it, and they have the same answer, that when the master channels a deity, the light and the radiance and the energy can be so powerful that they have to sort of protect ordinary people from that radiance. If you could see their eyes directly fully, it would be so powerful that it may knock you unconscious for days, weeks, or even months, and your husband could complain. Then the shaman would get beaten up, or the lama, by the husband. But that's both. I've had that same answer from both a Tibetan lama and also from a shaman, that it's because at the time of invocation, the energies and the radiance is so strong. And of course, this shines out through the eyes. So to protect ordinary mortals from that vast brilliance for which they are psychologically and spiritually and karmically unprepared. Reminded me a little bit of when I was a kid and someone brought up the issue of, you know, God and God experience, and someone quoted one of the early Christian mystics, which said an ordinary human has to train in prayer and meditation for a long time before they can have the full experience of God or the Godhead. If they were just to have it in their present state of mind, it would be so overwhelmingly brilliant that they wouldn't be able to endure the radiance and the intensity. I think it's the same kind of idea, that in a very deep state of spiritual ecstasy, the brilliance from the master shamans and from invocation masters, lama masters, can be overwhelming. I think it might also be a little bit in reverse, just to keep not to allow the shaman to get and the lama to become too distracted from the invocation ritual by surrounding activities. Because as you see at this festival, people are jumping very wildly and they're going completely into trance and absolutely forgetting where they are and who's around them. It's just a reminder who sort of keeps them, you know, not falling into the fire or bumping into, you know, like Byampa Dorje is quite old. Any of those guys could like bowl them over if they bumped into him. But for 3-4 days, day and night, they're all dancing and singing like that very, very intensely. And no one seems to get hurt, or rarely, very rarely does anyone get hurt.
My question is about flying horse. You were talking about that. You were talking about trees as one of the...
About what?
Trees.
Trees?
Yes. What about wolves? I thought that wolves, when they were... Or are they all gone there? Because I thought they were a big part of their culture.
Right.
And of shamanism.
Yes, correct. Yes, I didn't mention the wolf in the... In the thing, I didn't want to scare the ladies. But in reality, yes, like Byampa Dorje in his gear has quite a few wolf skins hanging. And very, I think on some of his costumes, one can actually see wolf skins hanging from his, over his chest and things like that. And also they have a special stick that they use, which is in the shape of a wolf's foot. And has a wolf skin fur sort of sewn onto it, which is used for exorcism and touched onto people. You know, in the shamanic world, it's said the three greatest predators in the world are men, wolves, and eagles. These are the three great predators. They also had tigers, but they didn't regard the tiger as such a predator compared to the wolf and humans. What?
Because of the pack? Wolves
maybe because they're so much noisier. I don't know. But anyway, those three are given a special quality. And, you know, shamans are meat eaters. So very often, if they kill a wolf, they will eat, you know, the different parts of the wolf will be eaten to cure different parts of a person. Like if you've got bad kidneys, the kidney of a wolf will cure your kidneys. A bad heart, the heart of the wolf will cure the heart, and so on for different bodily parts. But in general, of course, a wolf is a sacred animal, so they would only kill one in very special circumstances, and only if used in a sacred way. And only if they thought they had the blessings, I think, of the wolf pack. Now, I think it's very similar to North American natives, where this idea that humans as predators are the only predators that can kill wolves. A tiger generally will never attack wolves because the whole pack will attack the tiger. And so only humans can really kill wolves and get away with it. And so we're kind of the ones that keep the wolf pack healthy. If it's done
in that kind of balanced, harmonious way. I think that kind of thought is there. My first best friend in Mongolia, when I went there in 2003, I made friends with the curator of the National Museum, an old guy called Haida, very, very wonderful old man. He was 76 at the time, and he died 3 years later. And when he died, in his will, he told me that he had left in his will that his body should be carried to his homeland and laid out at the outskirts of the forest where the wolves could eat it. And with the very old Mongolians, that was a kind of a common belief. Of course, unfortunately, under the communists, many of the younger generation became totally culturalist in that respect. So now every young Mongolian has an SUV and a set of rifles and goes out riding across the steppes and just shoots whatever wild animals they see. It's a sort of great, great cause of concern for environmentalists as well as for culturalists.
Hi. So my question is, what do shamans charge for the services? Is it money? Is it animals? Do they do it for free? What's the transaction like?
Mm-hmm. I think it's, I'm sure it's changed over the centuries. You know, in the modern, modern times, it differs with different shamans. But shaman rituals that I've gone to, there's no set fee. Like most shamans set up on their lucky days. So in Ulaanbaatar, for instance, there's probably 500 or more practicing shamans. Some have an apartment, some have a gear, some have a wooden house. They'll just set up, they call it their office, because that's the word used in Mongolia for wherever a doctor works or a lawyer or any professional. And so then people come and gather, and poor people offer a little bit of money, or if they're farmers, they'll offer, you know, vegetables or whatever. If they're herdsmen, they may offer some meat or some butter. It's very big in horse milk bear season to offer a tub of horse milk bear. And I've never seen any of the shamans I've visited have a set fee, a particular fee for general visitors. Usually the offering is from the, because it's got to do with himor, you see, it's got to do with your horse energy. So what you offer is really in accordance with your means more than a set fee.
I'm curious if you have heard of a movie that came out a couple years ago, and you may have comments about it. The title is Horse Boy, and it's about a couple, a documentarian whose son was autistic, and he ended up going through Mongolia and ended up eventually at one of the camps where they were riding reindeer.
Right.
You may have heard of it.
Yeah, I know of the, it was, came out as a book, and the book was a bestseller. Then it was made into a movie, and it certainly did wonders for horse tourism in Mongolia. National Geographic immediately set up horse tours, and they've been very successful, as have many other groups around the world. You know, among Genghis Khan's idea of eight horses of happiness, there's 3 million people and humans in Mongolia. There's 25 million horses. And so, for instance, a friend of mine has, I think, 2,000 horses. And his dad was a horseman by trade. This guy's a professor. But when his dad died, he left all the horses to him rather than to the other sons, just figuring he was a professor, he'd keep the herds together and manage them well. And so they have, basically the way they run, there's no fences in the country yet. And so basically in the winter, you put one stallion with 25 mares. It's a nice country to be a stallion in. And you'd let them just run wild in the winter. And say, in his case, he's got 40 herds of 25 like that. And then you have a number of cowboys ride around during the winter just to be sure that wolves aren't ravaging any of the herds too much. And of course, if you got a tough stallion, the wolves won't. So it's up to the stallion. And if that stallion isn't doing a good job, you take away his mares and give them to another stallion. And sell him to the soup kitchen. I don't know what you do with him, but anyway, he loses his girlfriends. But that's, so they run wild all winter, and they basically eat, you know, just free graze, free range graze. And in the summer, in the winter, they go to very remote places, and in the summer, they all move near towns, and the mares all produce horse milk to make horse milk beer. Horse milk beer basically tastes like a Turkish kefir, a slightly acidic yogurt, but very drinkable yogurt, very thin, like a combination of milk and yogurt together kind of stuff, and slightly tangy. They don't like put yeast in it, amazingly. They use a big horse leather bag, which has the yeast from the previous in it. And they just add the horse milk every morning and then tie it up, and it ferments very, very quickly and becomes 2 to 3%. In the summer, the monastery's empty, and they all move to the country near the herds of horses. And for 2 weeks, they just drink a gallon and a half of this stuff a day. And it gets rid of all the stress of monastic living. And the immunity booster from all the flowers that the horses eat is said to keep you healthy for the whole year. When I was there, one of the first lamas I met, Dembrel was his name, which is a mispronunciation of the Tibetan word Tendrel. And I think he was 92 or 93, and just spry as like a 60-year-old or something. And he used to come visiting me all the time and come bursting into the house full of beans and say, okay, what Dharma topics do you have to talk about today? And do you need help with any texts? And blah, 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 blah. They used to say that when he's a young man, after coming back from drinking the horse milk wine, his memory would be so good that he could memorize a whole book in one day. So they had to limit the number of pages he was allowed to memorize for the few months after his annual monthly horse milk beer. So any of you with bad memories, that's a good cure.
How does the personal power of the shaman stack up against someone who uses spontaneity? So in other words, you know, you have to be chosen to be a shaman, or you decide to be a shaman.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. Most shamans, it's a calling, usually from a near-death experience. Very often someone will get deathly sick, and they'll keep dreaming of their ancestors, parents, grandparents, some dead people, basically, and who are speaking to them and saying, they'll say stuff to them like, you know, you need to do something in your life to fulfill the wishes of your ancestors, and that you're not fulfilling the wishes of your ancestors. If you die, in other words, you don't fulfill the wishes of your ancestors. They didn't go through all that trouble of, you know, raising kids and feeding them and nursing them and blah, 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 to have you die at age 20 or 30. And so they want you to live a long, fruitful life and fulfill the aspirations and the legacy of your genetic line. So very often you'll have ancestral dreams or a near-death experience with sort of sickly visions, delirious visions, one of those two. And sometimes just a master shaman will be called because you're so deathly ill, and will say, if he doesn't take up spiritual training, either as a lama or a shaman, then he or she won't do well, won't last. One of Gyanpa Dorje's own daughters, for instance, started having very disturbing dreams when she was in her mid-teens, and couldn't sleep and was starting to go a little bit bonkers by the sounds of it, becoming very psychotic. And so she asked him to do a trance, and in one of her dreams, she had a dream in which the ancestor said to her that you have to go to your father's homeland and do a shamanic ritual on the foot of our hereditary sacred mountain. And so she asked her dad about it, who did a trance and verified that it wasn't just a deluded dream, that it was a clear prophecy dream. So she went and she did it, and fell in love with doing it and became a shamaness herself and now lives as a shamaness. And her life totally changed. Her sickness went away and her troubled mind went away and she became totally vivacious. So usually it's a calling. Usually someone doesn't just say, I want to be a shaman, please train me. It can happen like that. Some people can just want to be shamans and ask to be trained, but more often it's a calling.
I wonder, is the purpose of the transfer some kind of spiritual progression or enlightenment, or is there any method to it?
Well, one hears different statements made about trance and what's being done, but the idea is that when a spiritual force comes into the shaman has all of the spiritual power of that spiritual force. Now, if we were to put that in a Buddhist language, in Tibetan and in Buddhism and in India, you know, when an oracle calls a deity into his or her body, that vessel of the oracle temporarily gains the power of that deity or of that spiritual force. Gains the clairvoyant powers, gains the wisdom, gains the mystical or magical powers, the siddhis. And so as a result, what they do in trance is not just a person doing it, like a doctor doing a healing or a psychologist or a psychiatrist doing a consultation. It works on a deeper spiritual energy level, a hemor level. So that belief is strongly there.